All right, so the first question I'll ask you is, how have you been able to engage your feminist ideology on campus?
I guess the sheer presence, my presence, is part of it, and to show the leadership and be able to provide that role modeling that oftentimes we look for in retention programming. And with that, you know, I not only increased the diversity of the CJ department, but it was also evident with American Indian Studies and even in the School of Education, the majority of the students were women, and the professors for that matter, but it just seemed like we needed to perpetuate that. Mm-hmm. And make sure that there was a solid maintenance of what was already established.
Sure.
So I guess I was part of that.
Okay.
I was here during 9/11. That was very interesting in the sense that I saw a lot of students react and respond in different ways. I was actually in front of a CJ 105 class, which was like 140 some students.
Mm-hmm.
And we had it up on the big screens as we watched the video and the coverage, and it was just mind-blowing. You know, and we started to talk about different things like women in combat and, you know, what roles women would play in this war. So, I mean, there's that aspect of it, too, just managing as we went along and realizing what was happening globally. And then it was happening right to us, right here. So in that sense, my ideology, I guess, is, you know, again, that presence.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to keep a cool head in crisis situations and making sure that people understand the need for survival and endurance and resilience.
Sure.
So those pieces of it are all there. I guess one of the things I got to do was to teach as part of the what I call the Wildflower Program. Actually, there are quite a few of us who call it the Wildflowers. But it was a grant program put together with the School of Education. And essentially, the intent of the grant was to increase the number of Native American DPI-certified teachers. And there was a cohort of 10 women going through the program, and I had the privilege to teach one of their classes.
Okay.
And that was really cool.
Sure.
And when they graduated, they managed to increase the number of certified Native American teachers by 35%.
Wow.
So a serious impact.
That's great. Has this program been able to continue?
No.
It's just the 1 year?
It was, well, they attended several, it was that one cohort.
But the one
cohort,
that's, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
What year did that start?
Oh, it was before I came here, so that would have been 2002?
Okay. Also, more related to campus, too, is maybe what would bring in how you've been able to be a role model and engage your feminist ideology is what awards or recognition have you received from the university?
You know, that blew me away. To receive recognition so quickly. I was just dazzled, I guess is the best word, by even coming on campus and being announced as the Knight Journalist in Residence. It's just something I wasn't accustomed to. There was a lot of celebration around that grant that I just had no idea about before coming here. So, I mean, it was really a prestigious position that I didn't even know that I was fulfilling that role. Then, in my teaching, in the PR 270 class that I'd done, there was a piece, one of them was on 9/11 with Northwest Airlines and the collapse of the airline industry. But then the second semester we did it, it was based on a discussion that we got into in class. And it was about how do you value diversity on campus? And so we put together a PR campaign, essentially, to talk about diversity and its value, and you know, the fact that it's an investment by the students to make sure that there are diversity scholarships available for you know, all kinds of people that are interested in accessing university. So that was a big one. And it was funny because Ron Satz actually signed off on our press release. He said, great job on this, you know, I was telling my daughter this morning. He said, he sent it through interoffice mail, and I just showed Dr. Gordon, you know, who was the head of the department at that time, and he said, wow, that's so cool. He's like, we need to get a copy of that. And I said, it's just a memo. You know? He's like, but it's from the provost. And so it was just like this grandiose gesture, and I was like, okay, I guess that's the way things are done here. So, I mean, it was a really different culture that way. Sure. So acknowledgement and recognition, I guess, are a bigger part of this culture than I'm normally accustomed to, say, like it was in the tribe or different things. And it wasn't, but soon after that, I had an upper-level PR class, and we ended up doing a project with Ellie Phillips Senior Center. Mm-hmm. And I had said, well, you know, anything that I'm doing here on campus, I really want to make sure that we do the application portion of it. To me, in education, that's one of the things that universities have typically lacked in the past, is that, you know, lots of theory and not so much with the experiences. And I think that's where service learning really engages that possibility. So, with that particular project, we ended up doing a kind of a revitalization of the Senior Center with its programming and new program director. We had a student in there that was an employee, and that year, Don Mowry was a bit of a stinker because he didn't tell me ahead of time. But he had, you know, like, Mike Rindo and different folks contact me mm-hmm. on the side asking me about, well, what do you think about service learning on campus? Well, you know, as a professor, you end up getting accessed a lot for any number of different things, but I didn't really know what he was getting at. So, I mean, I just gave him the quotes and whatever and thought nothing more of it. And Don said, oh, are you coming to the breakfast? I'm like, well, yeah, you know, I told you I would. And I get to the breakfast, and then all of a sudden, there's Dr. Satz again speaking, and then all of a sudden he says, you know, Barb Blackter McKenzie is this year's faculty mentor award winner, and I mean, my jaw just dropped to the floor. I couldn't believe it. It was just like, wow, you know, and I had watched during orientation, you know, people get like the teacher of the year and different things like advisor of the year, but that was completely unexpected. So that was neat. And then I had the Student Senate approach me as well, and they said, they had asked if I would do a speech for, I think it was a global awareness, but I did it on United Nations human rights issues with Native America. I think we talked a little bit about this last time, where I had students, young women come up to me who were Native, and they were just flabbergasted. They're like, we are just so privileged that you're here and very happy to see you in this role. I even had one offer me tobacco, which is our, you know, the symbolism with the prayers. So, I mean, I was definitely humbled with that, especially to be recognized by the students in that way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there was lots and lots of different things. When I went back to work for the tribe, then Sue Terrell contacted me and said, what have you been up to? And I told her, you know, and every once in a while I would get a call and see if I could teach a part-time class or whatever, not necessarily from Susan, but definitely from different folks in CJ and American Indian Studies, so I was thinking, well, you know, maybe she needs an instructor for something or other. And then she asked me to send her my resume to her. So I did that, and then it wasn't but soon after where she said, I've nominated you, and you are now accepted as the UWEC Woman of Color award winner for this year. And, you know, there again, jaw-dropping, absolutely jaw-dropping. And in that particular celebration, we were hosting it here that year, and it was just the most beautiful event. We had Renee McNeil doing a performance the night before with her artistry, and then she's like a preacher almost, and it was just amazing to hear her speak, because she not only was inspirational, but she incorporated so many different things in her presentation. She had us all singing during her speech. I mean, how many presenters do you hear doing that? And it was just so amazing. And for the first time in my life, I mean, and I do mean my entire life, I felt like I belonged to a community. Because here were all of these women from around the state, honored by UW Systems and their given universities, and there we were together doing all of these different works in different ways to help people, to help students. And, you know, in my case, the particulars for that year were that I had spent that year as the Executive Director of Education, and I'd had quite a few experiences where it certainly wasn't your typical K-12 advocacy kind of a thing where, oh, you know, this parent is having a tough time talking with this teacher. No, it was more like my child's been truant and running out on me at night, and I can't seem to get them to be accountable. You know, this one's been raped, that one's been harassed, bullied, and you know, these young Native women, and they're, you know, teenagers, and just having these experiences that I wouldn't wish on anyone. And to be able to sit down with as many girls as I did and do one-on-ones with them and to talk through some of these different things and to try and process what's happened to them and how they're going to turn a negative circumstance into a positive for themselves so that they can not only survive it but then, you know, succeed after that. Mm-hmm. You know, because I've seen far too many people just curl up in a ball and not come out from it. And that's you can't leave people that way. So that was part of the honor. I certainly didn't expect any recognition for it, and I certainly spent many, many hours in my office in tears with a lot of young women, just begging them to make good choices from there on out. You know, we had another circumstance where one of our students, she ended up overdosing on chlorocetin and was airlifted to Mayo to try and revive her. You know, and there too, when she came back, said, how are you going to engage in school? How are you going to drop back in now? You know, so in processing all of that, she seemed to make better decisions after that. And I can only hope that I was a little contributor in that.
Mm-hmm. Are you still able to work with youth in that way?
Not so much, but there are people who contact me. Apparently I have some kind of a referent social power within the community, and we were talking about this within the past couple of weeks because Black River Schools had two suicides and then another attempted suicide, and these were all young men at the high school. But I had parents, strangers, contacting me and saying, I heard you might be able to do something to help us with, you know, whatever the circumstance was. And that was things like asking for assurance, because there was also a threat that there were 7 kids on a list that was a form of a pact. And with these 3, one of them, of course, being under hospital observation, one of the other 4 was supposed to come to school and then basically take out the others and anybody else that could get along with it. With that particular kind of an issue, it's so difficult to maneuver to try and quell rumors mm-hmm. and get the facts out there. So I really appreciate the fact that I had been well trained in public relations. And then working with the superintendent, I said, you know, we've got 1 that's from the Native community, 2 that are not. How do you want to proceed? And we worked very closely for a few days there in making sure that people did have the sense of security that they were seeking to make sure their children were coming to school and that they would stay in school. You know, because it's all too easy after a circumstance like that to say, that's it, that's the straw that broke the camel's back, mm-hmm. and I'm going to homeschool my kids from now on, or transfer them, or move away, or doing all kinds of things. And that's something that we see a lot within the Native community, is that it's very nomadic. Oftentimes the kids are not necessarily in the same school district for more than 2 years.
Okay.
And then we also have a very high population of foster children, foster placements, and then we also have over 50% of our households are headed by a female, and it's not necessarily the mom. It could be grandma, could be an aunt, you know, just to try and help raise the kids. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that also then puts out their highly unstable environment for a lot of kids, because they don't know where they're going to go to sleep that night. And especially if the placement family has said, you know, that's it, we're done, and dropped them off at social services, you know, that's it. They really don't know where they're sleeping that night, and that level of insecurity for children is just so detrimental to their psyche and their learning and everything. Mm-hmm. And we see profound effects from that, like with Head Start Age, you know, and we, mm-hmm. Within the department there, we definitely had direct service provisions with Head Start, since we had 6 Head Start centers that we controlled. We had a number of children who, in foster placement, couldn't learn their alphabet. There's just simply a block. And through the research from the National Tribal Head Start Association, we were able to learn that it's actually quite common, because there's something about the pathways with that instability that actually blocks out the ability to learn alphabet. Wow. They could learn numbers, but they couldn't learn their alphabet.
Wow.
You know, and by the end of Head Start, of course, we want some form of letter recognition, you know, like 10 out of the 26 letters, at least in capital letters, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when screening them, you know, when you hit that point, and all of a sudden you go, why is this happening?
Yeah.
It's really a mystery. Mm. And of course, then by the time that they're 5 years old and integrated into a school district, we want to see more progress. Mm-hmm. And with the constructivist philosophy that a lot of schools have, one thing builds on another, so you can't move ahead until you've learned those basics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so all of a sudden, the kids are even farther behind, mm-hmm. And more disadvantaged. So, you know, I see the family in crisis, and I guess if anything, that's where I am a role model. I put myself out there, take the risks, and at the same time, we are very private about our family. You know, but I have a wonderful relationship with my husband and our 2 children, and you know, we have our household, and we've stayed there now for, 8 years. You know, so, I mean, there's there's something to be said for that kind of role modeling mm-hmm. as well.
kind of bringing it back towards campus, have you worked with the Women's Studies Department when you were working on campus?
I cross-taught with the Women's it was a program at that time.
Okay.
With the CJ course, and that was Women in Mass Media.
Sure.
So, you know, again, it was just after 9/11, mm-hmm. so we're talking about, you know, I had this exercise to say, it was kind of like the old game of, if I'm going on a vacation, what do I take with me kind of thing. Except it was more of a brainstorming session at a higher level and saying, if you were a photojournalist going into combat as an embedded reporter, what would you do? You know, what would you take with you? What if you were stopped at any given location and told to put on a burqa or skirt and veil, you know, at minimum, how would you respond to that? You know, what is it about your responsibility to your news organization and your job, which is the whole reason that you're there, versus how you're going to express yourself within a different culture mm-hmm. than your own, and try and pay your respects, but at the same time maintain your power and authority to do your job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was a big point of discussion for us in a couple of places. Again, I tried to do a lot of differentiated instruction where students could choose their topics and things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I made that available for service learning. So there again, we were hitting a pretty high percentage, about, I'd say upwards of 40% of my classes would definitely do at least the 15-hour requirement. And in those particular cases, they did so much. It was amazing that I had a young man in my class who said, you know, the girls team, girls soccer team's been asking me for a long time to come and coach, and I just haven't done it. Could this, you know, count for my service learning? I said, well, how are you going to make that apply to your major, what you're doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he explained all of that, and we were able to work it out, and he actually got the 30 hours done.
Sure.
So that was pretty fascinating, you know, and he backed it up, of course, with research and so on. I had some amazing young women coming in and doing kind of like what I did in college, which was court watch mm-hmm. kinds of things, and the things that they were able to bring to class, of course, you know, no particulars, but to talk through some of these issues of, you know, family abuse, mm-hmm. Power and authority within a relationship, those types of things. And we were able to talk through some of that, and that was also fascinating. And there again, you know, they back it up with the research, and it was just really fantastic, you know, but we weren't, you know, those are two very different parts of the spectrum in the sense that, you know, one seems almost like play and the other one seems so, so serious.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I got to say that there was everything in between. So,
yeah.
You know, lots of different things. And with so many students, I would say that, let's see, probably taught the course at least three semesters, so it was good.
Staying on the topic of the Women's Studies now department, used to be program, what is the importance of having a Women's Studies department or program on our campus?
It's fantastically important. I mean, part of the whole reason that we study the other, and, you know, I take that from the traditional, stodgy academic approach. But the reason that we choose to study diversity at all is to appreciate that that there's a source to how I perceive myself, how I perceive others, how others perceive me, how do we all fit within the context of our environment. You know, and those very conceptual ideas are very basic to even religion, you know, ideas of, you know, where do I come from, who am I, You know, do I fear birth and death? If so, why? And I think women's studies, particularly from a women's perspective, and especially on the last one, because birth and death can be so close together, that it's really significant and important for the folks on campus to be able to think about those things before they're actually in the situations. And I think that that's part of what I promoted, was that people need to think about things before they get into them. Mm-hmm. Understand the consequences of their decisions, and you know, just to be able to maintain a position of creating options for themselves and exercising choices, and hopefully good choices. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we got into the ethics of different things as well. So, you know, in that sense, you know, women's studies is just so valuable to this campus. It's, it, you know, and I've said the same thing about American Indian studies. It's the way that you can study another culture, you know, through this academic telescope kind of a thing, and be able to say, okay, well, no, let's take it back and figure out how this applies not only to me, you know, how am I perceived, and then so on. It's just so incredibly valuable for people to, you know, whether it's a dual major, even as a singular standalone major, to know that focus of all of the topics that affect women, they need to be there.
Mm-hmm. What would you say is, you know, having this be the 25th anniversary celebration, you know, what kind of marker of importance is that here on campus?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, I think about 1985 and how things were then, and I think to myself, wow, you know, I was just graduating high school, just getting into college, you know, and I had all of these different opportunities and experiences yet to face. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's completely anecdotal from my perspective, but it also, I think in our last discussion we were talking about management, you know, women in management at that time, mm-hmm. versus women in management now. It's still very much a struggle, but there were even fewer then, and they almost had to almost cross-dress, I guess. Like I was talking about my sister wearing, you know, the ties and the suits, but mm-hmm. the skirt with the suits, to work. And, you know, she's totally a slacks kind of a person. But, you know, that was the corporate culture. And she was very accustomed to working in an organization where she would be the only woman in the boardroom. And that was astounding for that time frame.
Sure.
You know, and now it's getting a little bit better, but I think that there's still a long way to go in mm-hmm. terms of true equality,
yep.
whether it's by the numbers or even by the attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens.
Yep. and then kind of one of my last questions that I have for you, and maybe something that you might want to share is, in the past 25 years here on campus, do you have any memories of people or specific events relating to feminist ideology that you'd like to share?
I think one of the things that I consistently relate to campus is the Take Back the Night. It's just such an important show of solidarity, and the violence that continues to happen against women is just mind-boggling. And I see that living in a rural county, especially now. I mean, we just had a woman shot down there, and it was in a domestic issue, and you know, now her two boys don't have a mom anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bolton has grown so much and no matter what, it just seems to never be able to fulfill the complete need mm-hmm. that we have within society so that people understand, wow, this is really a big issue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can do all of this stuff everywhere else, you know, and whether it's in the Middle East or whatever, and it doesn't seem to address what's happening here mm-hmm. In the relationships, in the power and authority schema, whether it's socially or economically, it's all part of the same thing. And there is a certain amount of oppression that still very much exists, but it's not very much discussed. I think that that's something that in 25 years I've seen improvements, but it hasn't completely fixed itself or righted itself. Mm-hmm. That sense of justice is something I think that all people pursue, but unless challenged to think about, you know, like in the male-female schema, the idea of male as power holder, male as the benefactor of, you know, his story rather than her story. Those are all components that need to be understood. Not only men as the benefactors or the beneficiaries, but also women as the disadvantaged. And then how we can discuss that to get to a point of equity. And it's going to be a long time before we get there, because there are so many people, so many men in particular, who are more than willing to just say, you know, hey, I treat you equally, it's not my problem, you know, but it's like, historically, do you understand that you are the direct beneficiary of this kind of a power and authority structure, and that you get things that we don't necessarily, and you have attitudes toward different things that we don't, based on the fact that you've been this mm-hmm. beneficiary. And it takes a while for people to sensitize themselves to that.
Yeah.
And it's hard to be the person to point that out to them, just as much as it is hard to be the person in the position that has to face off with that that demon, or whatever you want to call it, that inequality. So at some point there needs to be some form of reconciliation. And whether that's an informal or very formal process, my hope is that UW-Eau Claire Women's Studies will be a major part of that in our local communities and in the outreach, and saying, you know, whether, you know, it's giving testimony in inequalities, and then trying to do some form of restorative justice. That's a possibility. And we used to have, I think it was a commission on racial equality, but I don't know that we have one on gender equality.
Yeah. I don't know that we do either. No, we have the commission on the status of women and liaison committee, from women's studies, but yeah, I don't know that we do.
And to me, that's something that we might want to pursue, mm-hmm. In the sense of being able to say, hey, let's get on the same page, and let's bring in as many people from the communities as we can mm-hmm. to better understand this power and authority and the beneficiary and the disadvantaged schemas.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Is there anything you wanted to share at all?
I think, you know, as I was thinking through this and having my daughter write it, one of the things that I'm so very pleased was to be able to get my master's here, and being able to be part of the community to do that. The other piece that I've noticed, where I was privileged through the night journalist position, was to see the advancement of the Hmong community here. And I'm really pleased to see this so-called changing of the guard. I don't know if you saw the article recently with Caitlin Lee. She made comment toward this, but they just hired a new executive director. And so the power has changed over from, you know, Joe Bichong to one of the Muas, I forget. He's an elder in the community, and he's been kind of keeping the Hmong Mutual Assistance Association together. And then now we've got this new executive director, and he was born here. And he has an excellent understanding of the issues that face the Hmong population. And he also sees it as a almost a changing of the guard for the community, in the sense that it's not all about refugee status anymore. Now it's integration, more immigration and integration and assimilation and acculturation issues. My concern that I've brought up to a couple of people is to say, well, maybe what we want to do is get the tribal elders and the Hmong elders together. And I would love to see that facilitated through the university so that they can talk about, you know, the fact that there are different responsibilities for the genders. It's not necessarily one is over the other, but they need each other in order to work together. You know, and like, birth is women's work. We know that. You know, there are certain things that men do, and hey, it's a man thing. And we accept that. I would like to see some of that to empower the Hmong community to have that sense of perspective over how they choose to acculturate within the United States, instead of being thrown into this situation of the first generation coming here as immigration, and then the second trying so hard to be American that they don't teach the third generation anything about what it is to be cultural and traditional. And then the third generation just swimming. And then the fourth generation, they've lost the language. They've lost a lot of the culture. Is that really what they want to do? And to me, that kind of understanding about different cultures is something certainly that the university is capable of doing. The question is whether or not it wants to make a priority and a difference in how we, as a, you know, a land of the free and home of the brave kind of a place, want to, again, have the community perceive us. It's just too significant and important to people, I think, to know who they are. And if they don't know who they are, how in the world can they, you know, start by loving themselves and then contributing to others, their own community, you know, with that positive sense of self? There's a lot to be said for it. And to know who you are, where you come from, who you belong to, all of those kinds of Midwestern phrases, you know, they're good people. Well, all of that comes from knowing who you are. So to me, that's very significant in the college experience, as well as, you know, this facilitation that we actually can rationalize, or not rationalize, but rationally go through the process and understand what it is to immigrate here. And then so that future generations of refugees, whether it's, you know, the Kurdish or Somali or whomever is coming to the United States now, can have their choices expanded so that they can make those determinations as a community rather than trying to just do it alone.
Okay.
All right.
Great. Thank you very much. Bye.